Welcome to Warbirds in Review, folks. I'd like you to meet Doug Matthews. Doug, come on up. Doug is the owner of this beautiful Corsair.
I know those of you who thought I was Captain Hudner are disappointed, but I'm not Captain Hudner.
Yeah, I'm afraid we've got some bad news for you. Captain Hudner is ill, and Doug is going to explain what's going on with him.
He made it as far as Chicago, and we had a car ready to go pick him up this morning, and he has some what seemed to be serious health issues. Of course, as you can appreciate, he's 88 years young, and so he called and said, please offer his apologies, but he's he doesn't think it's a good idea for him to travel up here today. So I'm sorry, because I know everybody here came to see him, and maybe a couple of you to see the airplane.
Well, maybe between Doug and I, we can relay his story to you. It's a wonderful story of bravery and one man's love for another man. These two gentlemen couldn't have come from more different backgrounds. And we'll talk about the story a little bit later. And we're going to take some questions from the audience also. But Doug, why did you decide to paint your airplane like his?
You know, I've had the airplane 4 years, and you've seen it here several times in marked for the Marine Corps. My parents were married, so I'd always wanted it to be marked in Navy colors. And being ex-Navy, but I never found the right combination of things to show me the scheme that really needed to be on this this airplane. I didn't want to do yet another great ace that had been recognized in some cases two and three times. So we wanted to find something that was unique. And in one of my alumni magazines from the Naval Academy, there was a mention in one of the, each class through the years, each issue has a class news column. And I see Captain Hudner mentioned, and it triggered something about his flight career in the Navy. And I started doing some research and then contacted him and found out the whole story, and was incredulous that no one had ever never marked an airplane for him, and he'd never had his airplane displayed in the markings. So, and this airplane is a Korean War combat veteran. It has actually off the Boxer instead of Leyte. But and I was hoping to have the pilot here, Obie O'Brien, who flew this airplane off Boxer during Korea on all the combat missions, here today, and he was unable to attend also. But it was incredulous to me that no one had ever done the Hudner story and marked the Hudner airplane. So that met my criteria for something that would be unique. And also the Korean War is kind of a forgotten event for some people, unless you participated, of course. And I thought, you know, we needed a few more reciprocating aircraft that were in Korea, because we certainly see the F-86s and T-33s and Sky Raiders are a good example. So that was kind of my reasoning.
You know, I don't know why they picked me to be the commentator this week. We're honoring naval aviation, and I was an Air Force guy, so that's kind of bad. There's always been a gentle, sometimes not so gentle, rivalry between the Navy and the Air Force. You know, who's the best pilot? But just saying this as an Air Force guy, anybody that can land on a pitching carrier deck at night in all kinds of weather after flying a combat mission and maybe even wounded has got my respect.
Yeah. Actually, we probably have some naval aviator current.
I'd like
or
all the
veterans.
Naval aviators in the audience to stand and be recognized. All the naval aviators, please.
Pilots, co-pilots, flight crews.
Thank you.
Also,
God bless you all.
Also, we have two naval aviators over here that are almost as old as Captain Hudner that are going to help pass out something when we're ready. Jim McGarvey, if you'd just step forward and wave. Jim's F-8. And Carl Statton. also F-8s, but both of them now are general aviation and warbird nuts, and just nuts generally. Of course, you know this is the 100th year of naval aviation. Mr. Eli and his Curtis Pusher jumped off the bow of a re-rigged ship in early part of 1911, end of January, I believe, January 27th or something like that. So 100 years of naval aviation. And this patch I was given is one of the commemorative patches that's available for the centennial, and they've asked me to remind you that it's available here in the Warbird gift shop.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shirt, beautiful patch, 100 years of naval aviation, 2011.
And there are various websites that mark the anniversary, the centennial. NavalAviationCentennial.org and several others. So if you want to see more on the centennial of naval aviation or buy some of the patches, the different patches and different decals, you can do that. So let's set the stage on the Corsair. I'm sorry I didn't get to hear the reenactors talk, so I don't know if I'm going to repeat something he said. And if I do, then, you know, just dial up YouTube or something. But the Corsair, there were 12,500 made, 12,560-something. The majority were made by Chance Fought. But the demand was so high that they subcontracted through Chance Fought. The government subcontracted with Goodyear in Akron, Ohio, and they made a bunch of them. And if they're made by Goodyear, their designator is an FG. FG-1D is the most prevalent one. And if they're made by Chance Fought, they're an F4U-1, or in this case, a -4. And there is also happens to be a third subcontractor, the Brewster Aircraft Corp, and they made maybe 200, and there were some problems somewhere, and the production was ceased. So the majority of them were made by Chance Fought. This is a -4 built in 1945. As I mentioned, it saw service in Korea. You can usually tell the later models. Some people come up and say, how come this thing has four blades? I saw one yesterday had three blades. It's one of those fake. They're all real. And the later models with a different model of the same engine, the R2800 Pratt & Whitney engine, had four-bladed props and some other modifications that would generate horsepower. Normal horsepower on this, without the water injection and without combat emergencies, capable up to 2,000 horses. It is a heavier airplane than, say, the other fighter that was thought to be the best fighter of World War II, until you think about it. And the thrust-to-weight ratio on a Corsair is actually about 20% better than a Mustang. The typical configuration in World War II was two drop tanks. Each of these drop tanks holds 150 gallons. You have 250 gallons internal. So that's 300 and 250 is 550 gallons, and you're burning, if you go way up high, say 25,000 feet, long-range cruise until you get to the fight, maybe 60 gallons an hour. So if you're a 23-year-old naval aviator, and you get lost, and you want to come back, try to find the boat, it's nice having hours and hours of gasoline. They go out. This model has 650 calibers. You can see before they launch them, they'd cover them in a gauze or a tape just to keep junk out of there and water. And then the crew chiefs, or in the case of the Navy, the plane captains would tell when he trapped back aboard, if this was all singed, they knew they'd had some fun on the mission. And typical mission would be two drop tanks and then 350 cals on each side, fully loaded with 50 cal ammo. And then when they came to Korea, they start sophisticating the weapons a little bit more. And so a typical package going out would be a single drop tank on the right fuselage pylon. And I don't know why it's on the right. My research hasn't told me why they hung it on the right instead of the left. But it probably has to do something with servicing on the deck. But they'd go, this is the typical configuration with a drop tank on the right, 500-pound bomb on the left pylon, and then eight the 5-inch air-to-ground rockets, and then a full load of ammo. So that you can see that in 1945, when the government, broke as it was, canceled all of the fighter production contracts, there was only one fighter continued in production, and it was the Corsair. And it continued in production through 1953. And even the French bought a good number of them as the Dash 7 model and used them in Vietnam at Dien Bien Phu. So it was a tremendous, it's a great air-to-air fighter. It's one of the best ever air-to-ground fighters with its loiter time and its weapons package, only to be replaced eventually in the middle of the Korean War with the Sky Raider. So imagine this in 1950, Korean War breaks out, we're in a hostile environment, not just with unfriendlies, but the weather was terrible, and everybody, the Army, the Marines, everybody calls up and says, send us your Corsairs, and these guys would show up, a flight of four aircraft, so four times all this ordnance, hang around a couple hours overhead, if you get in a fight, a tremendous time to have air support. So the Corsairs in Korea were predominantly air-to-ground support, close air support.
Doug, my first... All right, is it working now?
Yeah.
My first chief pilot at the airline was a Corsair guy.
Can you hear him okay?
Okay, that's better. My first chief pilot at the airline was a Corsair guy, and he called it old hose nose. Can you talk about the issues of bringing this thing aboard ship?
Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point. The aircraft went into emergency production when the war began, right about the same time the Hellcat got going. And Hellcat went out and was the predominant replacement for the Wildcat, the F-4, the F-4F, or the FM-2, depending on where it was made. And so the Hellcats got a lot of the air-to-air glory. Of course, David McCampbell being the high-scoring ace in the Pacific. And Corsair was produced, but there were some problems with its shipboard compatibility, they call it. And they were having, in those days, there were multiple cables. Nowadays, we only have four, but in those days, they had up to eight. And the aircraft would come in and it would bounce, and of course as it bounces the tail hook goes with it, hopefully, and it was skipping the cables and it was coming down hard and they had problems. So they gave it to the Marines because they would be predominantly land-based, and the aircraft did not make it to be a carrier-based operation in full-time until December of 1944. So you had about another 7-8 months of the war in the Pacific, and that was it. So its carrier-based operations were very limited. Tom Blackburn and VF-14 did a great job off the land-based bases before they got on the ship. It does have some peculiar aerodynamic characteristics. It's called old hose nose. It's also called the bent wing. Our Japanese friends called it whistling death. And so where did all those things come from? Big Blue Monster, I heard that referred to way back then. And, of course, and that was the way I referred to it when I first saw the airplane. You know, you see all these other fighters, and you get a concept in your mind, or if you've never seen one in person, you see a picture, and you imagine how big a fighter is. And when I imagine how big a fighter is, I see people walking around in videos of a Spitfire, and I think, okay, that's how big a fighter is supposed to be. And then the first time I actually got to see a Corsair, you know, I thought, God, I'm too close to it. And I kept walking. It kept bigger and bigger. It's just huge. It's the, you know, it's, I don't know if it's bigger than a P-38. It probably weighs as much, but it weighs a lot. It weighs a lot. A lot of horsepower. But it's a big airplane. And because they extended the nose, you know, this one of the weirdest things about this airplane is these huge wings, no fuel. No fuel in the wings. That makes a great air-to-air fighter, because unless it gets you in your fuselage tank, you know, they can rip up the wings. The controls are unboosted, so it's a real sturdy fighter. So one of the things that was amazing to me is no fuel in the wings, except for the early models. And the second thing was the bent wing. Why did they do that bent wing? Well, it was so this, as you can see, if I was to rotate this prop around, it's going to clear the deck at, in this landing attitude. If I don't misjudge my landing attitude, it's going to clear the deck by about 10 inches. And that's with the struts mounted at the low point of the wing. So for some unknown reason, in the middle of the night, someone said, well, let's just bend the wings. I don't think it's been done too often since then. But anyway, why are the wings bent? The wings are bent so that the prop will clear the ground. Now, if you were over at Grumman, a few miles away at the same time this was being produced, and they were trying to come up with the follow-on to the Hellcat, and they come on with the Bearcat. If you see a Bearcat around here, which is two airplanes down, the Blue Angels airplane, you'll see the Grumman's suggestion was, well, we're not going to bend the wings. We're just going to make a landing gear strut that's extremely tall, and that way we'll get the prop up. But if you think about that, if I have a landing gear that's another foot long, then I've got to locate it somewhere else where it's going to come up and interfere with either my fuel or my ordnance load. And of course, the Bearcat is famous for hardly carrying anything. They cut down on armor and ordnance and bullets and everything. So we have a gull wing so we can keep our sturdiness for the carrier landings, and we can carry a lot of ordnance, a lot of fuel, and none of that's going to be interfered with. The other strange thing you'll see is the cockpit is pretty much near the trailing edge of the wing. And when after the prototype, when they stretched the front to make a bigger fuselage tank, you can see the distance from the headrest to the front is like 10, 12 feet. So you've got this huge blue nose out there, and the guys would call it the hose nose, but it just sticks way out there, and you feel like if anybody ever saw the GB Racer from the 1930s, where the pilot sat all the way back by the rudder and 90% of the airplane is out front, that's what you feel like when you're flying a Corsair. It just feels like, you know, I'm glad they remembered to put a seat back here. Otherwise, you know.
Did they bring it aboard ship?
I'm having all kinds of mic problems here.
Did they bring it aboard ship with in a slip so they could seal around the nose?
No. Did they bring it aboard in a slip? No. You're so close to stall speed. As you can see, when those flaps hang down like they are and they're segmented and they really are like a barn door, tremendous drag, and you want to come across the tail end of the ship at the right altitude, the right attitude, and just barely above the stall speed, so your chances of catching one of the hooks is greatest. So the Navy would do, rather than more of a traffic pattern like a general aviation pilot might be used to, Navy would come in overhead, come into the break, and just one continuing circle, and you're circling the whole approach, and you've got the boat out the left side of your windshield, and you're looking at it, and you don't turn straight until you just cross the tail. And you turn straight, and you're watching the LSO. The LSO's out there until he gives you the cut signal, and then...
So you're in a constant turn rather than a slip.
I'll probably break this one, too. So you're in a constant turn all the way around, and then at the last minute, just kick it out and hit the deck.